panel, as you can tell, have debated these issues. They know each other quite well. I'm not going to give you a chance now to respond to each other's comments. That would take far too long. I'd much rather get the audience involved, and then you can take that opportunity to respond if you would like. So we've got about half an hour left for discussion. I'll take questions, and if they're not, then we'll do them in groups. But let's start first of all, first row, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just going to the concluding summary by Dr. Gibner, I was looking at item number two in three recommendations. It says, position itself, that the European Union, itself as a neutral arbiter on non-traditional security issues. I wonder how realistic that is, given. I just have some doubts. Given the very close convergence between the European Union on the one hand and NATO on the other, in terms of membership, culture, history, at the bonds in Article 5 and so on, whether the European Union can actually separate itself, insulate itself from the overall Atlantic alliance and be something completely different. For example, on the issue of China being a market economy, where are we now? I don't know. I'd like to hear from you. And second question is, related to that, that what should be the appropriate balance in terms of the European Union investing in efforts in containing or constraining China on the one hand and on leveraging China's growth to its own interest, to pursue its own interest on the other. So cooperation, competition, dilemma, if you like. And because you're sitting in London, I wonder what your thoughts are on the consequences of Brexit on all this that you've discussed. Thank you.
Now, I counted three questions there. So this is the way our audience usually goes. I start with one, but I've already punched three questions into one. So I won't take any more right now. So you shouldn't feel obliged to answer every single question. So pick your questions that you would like to answer. But Olivia, would you like to perhaps respond first of all on the recommendation you've made? The question of the non-security role that you highlight.
Yeah, so the idea that the EU could be an arbiter is really based on the fact that it does not, at the moment, have direct stakes, for example, in the South China Sea or in the maritime environment, as opposed to the United States. And as one of the studies in the report also shows, actually, perceptions towards the EU, although there is the conceptual gap, I completely agree, to take a stronger role in global affairs is rather positive, which is quite a surprise. When you think about the perceptions within Europe at the moment, so that could be some sort of kind of an opening if the European Union, I think, as it has done, or I think Robert didn't talk about it much, but that it comes in as a somewhat legitimate an actor who's known for upholding the rule of law, who's known for trying to enforce these issues, coming in and being between conflicting parties. So I think it's already done that on the kind of diplomatic level. So that was the idea behind the recommendation.
The second question was on China, and I think that is an extension of the first question, really. And I wonder, particularly with regard to China, obviously the economic relationship is dominant, but Michael, for example, you touched on the need to develop a more military, perhaps security-oriented posture as well. Do you see that playing into the EU-China relationship?
Well, we will issue relatively soon a new policy paper on China, where we will find some answers to this issue, because the last one we did was 2007, and the world has moved on. So that's coming out soon. We have to see when we will publish, because we don't want to kill one bird with the other. So we have a China strategy, we have a global strategy, and we have to deal with the market economy status. And we need a good scenario how we will deal with all that issue. Now, I think the EU is not trying to contain China. I think that's not that would be beyond our capacity. And I think it would be unwise policy on top of it. I think what we are trying to do with China is to engage China. I mean, we have these 45 dialogues going on, and everything you can imagine, basically, and we have to streamline it a little bit, but the whole is engagement. And I always, when we talk about the US policy of the pivot or the rebalancing, as it is called, that's very often perceived by China as a sort of effort, and they borrowed the expression from the Cold War, of containment, I think, which is not right. It's a different concept on the Cold War area. But the message we always give to the Chinese is, well, you have to engage. You have to engage, and you also have to shoulder responsibility. If you want to be a regional power, yes, that's what China wants to be, but then you also have to shoulder responsibility and behave responsibly. And that brings me again to the rule of law element. And if I want to talk about with China, and we do talk with the party, whenever I go to Beijing, I try to do the double act. And the Ministry of Foreign Affairs is not terribly pleased if we do a double act, by the way. Then we also have to talk in security terms with the military, the PLA. I mean, a lot of the South China Sea issues is driven also by internal competition of the different military branches in China. I'm perfectly aware of that. And when I go to the Shangri-La dialogue in Singapore, then we talk a lot to the military, who are there. The disadvantage is a little bit they bring all the military people there they want us to meet, and that's not necessarily the ones who call the shots. So that's another. So I'm trying to get into that into that issue a little bit, and on the mediation, well. I think mediation, but Robert knows that better. I think if you don't have your own ambitions, that helps. But you're only a good mediator if you have something to offer. Mm-hmm. You have to have a carrot and a stick. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a carrot and a stick, then in my mind you will not turn into a good mediator, because you have to push people a little bit, and sometimes just if you are negotiating a deal, sometimes you need the last push. And if you don't have the possibility to make that last push, then you don't succeed. So yes, to a certain extent, we can. We have done that in Aceh. We are active in the Philippines. We are trying to do a little bit in southern Thailand. We are trying to talk to the Thais that the military regime is perhaps not the best one we have ever seen. But without strong influence, you have to know your limits.
Mm. How does that look from the Chinese perspective?
Well, I later take up on that, but I want to make a specific case on Brexit in here, between China and Brexit. And China has been extremely concerned about Brexit because they're simply thinking the UK are mad in this case. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason is because the UK has been one of the strongest supporters for China to become a market economy in the past 20 years. And therefore, China does not want to lose that support, does not want the UK to lose in the party membership. And secondly, because there's an enormous amount of investments from China in the UK. So since you open your eyes in the morning, you start with your Weetabix, then you go to the Heathrow Airport. This is all now owned by the Chinese. And even the water you're drinking now is owned by the Chinese. So with all that enormous amount of investment stakes in this country, 9% of Thames water owned by the Chinese International Corporation. So unfortunately, there's enormous economic risks to have a Brexit. And then China won't think to withdraw that investment from the UK after only being merely invested in 3 or 4 years. This is just wrong. So this is the second element. And for the third element, to developing a good so-called golden era of China-UK relations has been a hallmark for Xi Jinping's diplomatic legacy. So if the UK withdrawn from the EU, and now somehow this partnership seems to be less likely to receive any return investments. So this is another concern, somehow domestic confidence concern for Xi Jinping himself. That's why they're extremely concerned. So these are like three reasons why China doesn't want to have a Brexit.
Can I say something on the, this is on the first question, and that is, of course the European Union's not neutral, but it's not the same as NATO either, namely because the US isn't there. And so, for example, to take another of the Myanmar examples, when there was a the EU's been heavily involved in financing a not very successful peace process so far. When they signed a what was called a national ceasefire, but was actually a relatively partial ceasefire, the Kachin and others had originally wanted the US and the UK to be involved in, to be witnesses or something of the kind. It ended up with the European Union being a witness because, well, it's sort of Western, but it's not quite so visibly Western as the US is. Now, whether this was a good thing or not, I don't know. But and one of the things you can guarantee about the European Union is, because you've got 28 member states and they spend a lot of their time quarreling, they're not going to do very much damage. The idea that this is somehow could be an imperial venture, it's not possible. So it's not neutral in terms of positioning itself midway between other great powers. It's neutral in the sense that it's quite difficult to get it to agree on much more than rule of law, human rights, motherhood. So it's a rather...
It's less threatening.
It's a less threatening actor. No. And, but that has a merit.
But we have the Russia sanctions.
Yeah, well, that's because Russia broke some pretty fundamental rules, international law.
But we managed sanctions.
Oh, yeah, no, well, we've done that. We had... we did the we actually did the not just the Iran sanctions, but we actually brought together a large coalition on Iran.
Okay, I want to bring in Thomas here. I mean, clearly no empire has been built on the basis of Brussels bureaucracy, and I think that's a fairly stable prediction. Yeah. But you also come in.
Just one word on containing China or taking a strong
just
stance.
Constraining.
I think what we rather do is, I mean, from the development perspective, it would rather be to socialize and nudge China into somehow a norm community of international donors. This is also of very limited effectiveness.
It's what we hope to do with Russia.
And it's a slow process, if at all.
I'll give you a chance to come back, but I do want to give others a chance to come in, please. I'll start here with you and then I'll come to you. Yes, please.
Thanks, and thanks a lot for the whole report and your presentations here. It's quite illuminating. I have two questions, one very broad and one much more specific. Starting with the broad, and that's challenging the whole premise, perhaps, of the report, which is any new EU-ASEAN strategy. It's a bit different in the report, because there you differentiate between different regions in China, ASEAN, East Asia, and so on. But still, you seem to have the ambition of providing ideas for a strategy towards the whole of Asia. But Asia is not a political concept as such. It's very different from Africa or Europe, of course, or South America, for that matter. There's no political organization. I don't need to tell you all this, right? There's no identity on the continent. So why does the EU need to have an Asia strategy? Why can't it have China strategy, ASEAN strategy, India strategy, and so on? Why even bring all of them together just because all the other continents do that? It seems a bit artificial to me. And my second point is to Sir Robert, on the issue of the political prisoners, what you write about in the report, which I found very interesting insights. Where do you think did the EU help your efforts? How would you assess the balance between your individual contribution or contribution of other European diplomats towards the release of political prisoners and the role of headquarters, Brussels, in either just letting you do what you wanted to and letting you negotiate as you did, or helping you or even impeding you. So what was the role between the, you are there in Burma and the EU?
Robert, do you want to start with that? Then I'll ask the panel to respond to the first question, which is really important, the idea that there is indeed such a thing as the Asian region that you can have a strategy towards. Yes.
But no, the answer is I don't think my personal contribution was very important. I was happy that I had the particular conversations I had. I think probably the same thing would have happened in due course anyway. Maybe it accelerated a little bit. I was only the representative, but I was...
Could you maybe tell the story quickly? Because probably
Others may not have read. No, well, it's actually, for me personally, it was a slightly dramatic moment, because we'd been... EU sanctions were very specifically tied to two things. The inclusion of the National League for Democracy in politics and release of political prisoners. And when the... When Myanmar started opening up, first time I and Mr. Fassino went, where he's EU special representative for Burma, and the first time we went there, we went around telling everybody, if you do these two things, we'll lift sanctions. And I worried because these meetings were very formal and everyone was very polite to each other, and I wondered whether it was really getting through. And eventually I had a side conversation. Actually, while I was shaking his hand on the way out, I had a conversation with the foreign minister and said to him, listen, you've got to understand that we imposed these sanctions because we saw you killing monks in the street. So you've got to find something dramatic to do to get them lifted. And I suggest you don't just release all political prisoners, as we say, do it all on one day. That'll get you headlines all across the media in Europe. And he looked a bit surprised. And then later that evening at a dinner, the deputy minister said, could I please repeat to him what I'd said? And I repeated it to him, and he looked a bit thoughtful. And then we all went off, and I changed into my jeans and got ready to go home, because this was all in Naypyidaw and we'd gone down to Yangon. And then I got a call on a very bad line from the deputy minister saying, excuse me, but when you say release all political prisoners, could you please tell us exactly who you mean? Well, given that this country had been refusing to discuss the subject at all, had been unwilling to talk to people who were going to mention political prisoners, it was actually an extraordinary question to be asked. And I said, yes, of course, we'll give you a list tomorrow. Well, then we had a big problem because we didn't know who we meant, because we'd been saying release all political prisoners for the last 15 years and nobody had kept an accurate list. So we got, but we got some NGOs together, and in the next 24 hours we put together a list which was not very accurate, but contained about 2,000 names. But by the end, the government released political prisoners, not as I'd suggested, in one go. They did it in a much more sensible fashion, bit by bit, to see if it worked. In the end, they had people from the National League for Democracy in the Interior Ministry going through lists saying to them, yes, he's a political prisoner, he's a political prisoner. And these were released because of EU sanctions. Now, my specific role, I was the lucky person to be the bearer of the message at this particular time. Maybe I managed to find a way of dramatizing it a little bit. But what really matters is not me. What really matters is 28 European states. It's a big potential trading partner. The symbol of EU sanctions. Much easier to get EU sanctions lifted than American sanctions. American sanctions are imposed by Congress. They still haven't been lifted, most of them. So that's all.
Okay, but now...
I enjoyed myself, but it was the credit was not for me.
Panel members, the question of Asia as a region. Is it realistic to target the region in a strategic vision? And this also goes back to Robert's earlier point about Burma dominating the agenda and not China, but yeah. Now it seems, yeah. If we look at what the debates in the British Treasury in Germany, China seems to be dominating the agenda.
Well, I'm saying in the paper at one moment that we need a policy towards Asia which has to be more than a China policy. Yeah. So a China policy is not an Asia policy, and only a China policy is not Asia policy either. The approach which will be taken by this global strategy which we are preparing and which will be born in June has a rather functional approach. It has a functional approach with geographical elements. And I think it's a little bit the thinking in which areas the European Union is looking for cooperation. And I think there the Asia or the America or the neighborhood element comes in, because you will concentrate on different issues in different regions. So there will be some global issues. If we want to have cybersecurity, then it doesn't make sense to have only cybersecurity cooperation with Asia. You have to have it at the global global scope. However, there are some specific problems in Asia in cybersecurity called China, for example. So I think there are specificities for each and every region, but I agree. I'm not in favor of Asia as such, because Asia is very diverse, and I think it was Kissinger who in World Order comes up with a footnote saying, well, Asia that was developed by the Europeans as a concept and not by the Asians themselves. But I can also tell you now from the experience of being on a little bit on this conference trail for the last 20 years, you cannot go to a think tank or to an NGO discussion without having something which is called an Asia strategy, because they will always criticize you. You don't have it. You are navel-gazing. You don't know what you are doing. So you need a sort of guidelines. And we have broken it down. If we look, for example, there is a Central Asia strategy which was updated recently. There are the East Asia policy guidelines, and they have an interesting history, by the way. They started in 2005 because there was this big discussion whether the Europeans could lift the arms embargo against China, which was introduced after the Tiananmen. And when this discussion was started, I think it was Chirac who wanted to lift it, then the Japanese and also the Americans got up in arms and said, well, we have to explain to the stupid Europeans what is going on in the region. And we started the political dialogue. And the first concept, which was from 2005, was the basis for the dialogue, which was then published, because people knew there was something, and I still have a sort of typed version of it, it looks like. It was published in 2007 and was updated in 2012. But then we have a sort of Afghanistan strategy. So we are breaking it down in policy papers. But there is an overall view to a certain continent and region, I think, which, as long as you do it in a functional way, it makes sense. But of course, India is not China and is not Laos.
Thomas,
if I may second to this, again, from the development perspective, the functional view makes perfect sense. I mean, it's not an identity building undertaking, an Asia strategy, but if you think of issues, they have a regional dimension, like migration from one country to the other, conflicts which touch upon borders, pollution that so problems transcend national borders. It's basically the same problem we have in Europe, so it makes sense to think about regional dimensions to issues. They have repercussions in a certain geographic area. That could be one answer. It's not that we want to create and put together an Asian identity.
Okay.
For what it's worth, I think exactly the opposite. At least I think that I think if you want to be a political actor, then you have to deal with the political world, which is divided into countries. And what you really want, and I'm a bit skeptical of these great documents, what you really want is you want to have active ambassadors with potential for creative initiative, and those you have country by country. If you really want to develop relationships, that's where you do it, not by having grand strategies.
I won't give you a chance to respond there at this point, but I will take a last round. We have relatively little time left, so I'd like to take one, two questions, and then I think we'll have to draw a line there.
Yes, please. So my question is about the Asia-Europe meeting. So first, what's your view on what role does the Asia-Europe meeting play in the EU's relations with Asia? And then second, can it be a vehicle for an EU strategy towards the region?
Okay, and I'll take another question.
Yeah, my question is on EU engagement in the South China Sea, which also goes a little bit with the Asia strategy. Is that something that is possible, realistic? Because you said that, or it was said several times, that EU engagement in the South China Sea would be mostly about upholding the rule of law, and it will be a neutral or, you said, legitimate actor. Would that still be the case if it engages on this neutral position that goes against China's stance on this, because it sees it as a domestic issue, it's their sovereign sea or their territory? So doesn't this go against an Asian strategy again? And also, is there willingness, or do you think there is willingness within the EU to engage in a conflict, even if it's only about the rule of law, because this would again complicate relations with China, and we've seen how unwilling the EU has been on the human rights position or anything like that, like these complicated issues. So what do you think, what is your take? I guess it must be to Michael Reitenhardt.
Okay, I'll give you all a chance to respond. You may also want to take this opportunity to perhaps also pick up the challenge by Robert that forget the regional strategy, it's nation states. And this will have to be your concluding statement, so this is your last chance, because this round is between the audience and the drinks reception outside. I just want to remind you of that. Who would like to go first? Should we... Jerry, would you like to go first?
All right, okay. My answer is very simple in this case. I mean, regarding both on South China Sea as well as on China-EU relations, is as simple as that. You do not annoy your largest trade partner. You have enormous economic stakes in the region, and you don't want to get the whole things blow up. And at the moment, the European Union is facing under pressure of one crisis or another. You don't want to create another problem yourselves. So, by talking content in China, I don't think this is very wise. Thank you.
Robert, did you want to come in on any such questions about the regional dialogues? About
I only say on the South China Sea that diplomacy is the art of saying what you think without annoying people, and the freedom of navigation is not an Asian issue, it's a global issue.
Michael, would you like to wrap this up?
Well, Asia-Europe meeting, then there you give me possibility to talk for 2 hours. That's a little bit my It's a little bit my baby. I started in 1998, so we will have soon the 20th anniversary in Ulaanbaatar this time. I mean, the Asia-Europe meeting was founded in 1996. It was a Singaporean-French initiative to close a missing link, because there was a good relationship between Europe and the United States, and the United States and Asia, APEC, and the Asia-Pacific dimension of the United States, and there was not enough between Europe and Asia. And therefore, this dialogue process was created. It was filling a gap. It has developed over the years, but it has remained a dialogue process built on political, economic, and cultural people-to-people dimension. For the latter, there is the Asia-Europe Foundation in Singapore, which is the only institution of ASEAN. So I think one of the problems which we have with the Asia-Europe meeting is that it remains an structured, unstructured, without secretariat dialogue process, where people sometimes have problem understanding how can you talk for 20 years without achieving anything. I would not subscribe to that, but that's the perception of it. But I must say, if I look at the foreign ministers meeting and the meetings of heads of states and government, bringing 53 heads of states and government and ministers together, giving them the possibility to have bilateral meetings. That's quite an achievement, and dialogue and time is a very precious part of the life of any major politician. So I would not underestimate it. And bringing people together in one place and having all these bilaterals, that's a few hundreds actually, when you have 53, that's also a very good ecological footprint compared to individual traveling. So is it perfect? No, but I think it can serve the purpose, but we could do more. And that's one of the messages I'm always giving, and hopefully it will survive also in the global strategy, that we should do more on that. Well, South China Sea, I don't want to go now more into it, but South China Sea is a little bit of a misnomer in the political discussion, because what we are talking about is that if there is an international regime, an international treaty to which you have signed up, and UNCLOS, that's what is UNCLOS all about, the watch was reset to zero when UNCLOS was agreed upon. So that is the codification of international law of the sea. And if you don't play by the rules, this has nothing to do with the South China Sea in particular, it's about the rule of law. And I think therefore, may it be freedom of navigation, freedom of overflight, this is part of the global commons. And I think therefore, we are not even entitled, but we have to say something, otherwise we are not a serious player for the rule of law.
Okay. Thank you for that. Thomas. Just one word. I'm not questioning, of course, the importance of the nation state in politics. That was not what I wanted to say. And we seem to see the relapse into that kind of thinking in Europe right now. But at the same time, it is true that the nation state is not able to face the challenges we have, like climate change. I mean, these are transcending nation state borders. That's why I think the regional view makes sense, because these are entities, geographic entities, yeah, where there is close economic ties, yeah, if you want to achieve growth, yeah, if you want to solve conflicts or deal with issues like maritime governance, you need to look at beyond the nation state. That's what I wanted to say.
Okay, I think it's only fitting that Olivia gets the last word, having started us off on this.
Well, thank you, first of all, for the great discussion. I just wanted to say something on ASEM and why Asia. From my perspective, the main purpose of the ASEM platform is really this creating of networks. And my research was mostly about policy diffusion between countries. And these networks connecting politicians, connecting the think tank world, connecting scientists, are really the kind of conveyor belts of ideas. And so, yes, you could always say it's talking shops, or there's not much concrete things coming out of it, but you in all these forums, people learn from each other, people learn about each other. So I think it has a very important function. On the question of why EU-Asia strategy, so I think maybe we can discuss this later, but I would be curious why initially EU-Asia strategy, because I'm sure you were thinking about the same questions. And then if you look at the conclusion of the report, most of the articles say all strategies or cooperation should be needs-based on the nation-state level. And this idea of functional cooperation, which maybe will come out in the global strategy, is also going throughout the individual analysis. So I think that the EU-Asia strategy is really directed at the European Union. So to create that kind of talking space, to create, to put it really high on the agenda, because if I understand correctly, Federica Mogherini has a very busy schedule. Maybe Asia or Asian countries, even if they're nation states, are not at the top there all the time. So this kind of idea, talking space, unifying departments, and then also maybe building capacity on the different parts of the regions, I see that as the bigger element of developing such a strategy.
Great. Well, thank you very much. May I just point out again, this has just been published, please take a copy, take another copy for a friend of yours. We are very grateful to you all on the panel for having contributed to the report, but also to have come out tonight and debated the report. We'll make sure that this lands in the inbox of Federica Mogherini's office before the strategy revision is completed. And we will debate this further. There will be further events on EU relations with Asia, and once again, thank you to Olivia for having pulled this together and having made this possible. But please, before you join us outside for a drink and further discussion, join me in thanking the panel for the wonderful